Authors Use Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome once again to the program. Last week we ended with a quote from the Joseph Goldstein and Christine Feldman book, Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart. It ended like this: to understand the cycles of karma is to understand that we are really not different from anyone else. There's not one mistake we've made that has not been made before by another. Not one delight we've experienced that has not been felt by another. We see ourselves in others and they in us. We're not called upon to judge, but to respond with kindness and understanding. How can we know amid the 10,000 joys and sorrows possible in the changing circumstances of our lives what is truly good or bad, or what lessons we need? What matters is how we respond. What we create, how we act and respond, embodies itself not only in our own lives, but in the lives of our communities, our children, our world. How we hold the world in our eye and heart is what we and the world will become. Understanding the implications of our presence in the universe need not lead us into self-consciousness, blame, or judgment. Rather, this understanding encourages us to see the importance of being awake and aware in each moment of our lives. As a conscious participant in the creation of each moment of the world we live in, we have the power to heal, to love, to care, and to make our compassion visible. The path of awakening and loving is a path without end. We cannot measure the worth of a single loving action or the impact of a single caring gesture. We cannot know the results of a single meditation or evaluate the learning we will derive by meeting a single difficulty with open-heartedness. When we connect with the precious richness of living, caring, and connectedness, results fade in importance. We can only trust that the landscape we paint will be colored by our love and care. Well, don't you think that's a wonderful way to think of karma? What an extraordinary goal to aim for. To so paint our landscape that it will always be colored by our love and care. If we could do that, there would be no place for fear, hatred, anger, discrimination, and all the other pain-inducing reactions that we so often make space for. The wonderful Australian abbot Ajahn Brahm tells a story he calls What We Really Want that demonstrates something about this. It comes from his book Don't Worry, Be Grumpy, and it goes like this. The abbot woke up early one morning. Nothing unusual in that. But this morning he was awakened by the sound of something moving in the nearby shrine room. That was unusual because most of the monks would normally be practicing their morning chanting at this time. And in brackets he's written zzz. So he went to investigate. In the darkness he saw the silhouette of a hooded figure. It was a burglar. "What do you want, my friend?" said the abbot kindly. "Give me the key to the donation box, punk," said the burglar, brandishing a long, sharp knife. The abbot saw the weapon but felt no fear. He only felt compassion for the young man. "Certainly," he said, slowly handing over the key. As the thief frantically emptied the box of cash, the abbot noticed the robber's jacket was torn, his face pale and gaunt. "When was the last time you have eaten, dear boy?" "Shut up," barked the burglar. "You'll find some food in the cupboard next to the donation box. Help yourself." The thief paused for a moment in confusion. He was taken aback by the abbot's consideration for his welfare. Still pointing the knife at the abbot just in case, he hurriedly filled his pockets with cash from the donation box and food from the cupboard. "And don't call the cops or else," he shouted. Why would I call the police? Answered the abbot calmly. Those donations are to help poor people like you, and I've freely given you the food. You have stolen nothing. Go in peace. The next day, the abbot explained what had happened to his fellow monks and to his lay committee. They were all very proud of the abbot. A few days later, the abbot read in the newspaper that the burglar had been caught robbing another house. This time, he was sentenced to 10 years in jail. Just over 10 years later, the same abbot was woken up early in the morning by the sound of someone in the shrine room. He got up to investigate, and yes, you've guessed it, he saw the burglar standing next to the donation box carrying a sharp knife. "Remember me?" shouted the burglar. "Yes," groaned the abbot, reaching into his pocket. "Here's the key." Then the burglar smiled and put down the knife and said gently, "Sir, put away the key. I couldn't stop thinking about you all those long days in prison. You were the only person in my entire life who was kind to me, who actually cared about me. Yes, I have come back to steal again, but I realized that last time I took the wrong thing. This time I've come to take your secret of kindness and inner peace. That is really what I wanted in the first place. Please hand over the key to compassion. Make me your disciple." Soon thereafter, the thief became a monk and became rich beyond his wildest dreams, not with money, but with a wealth of kindness and inner peace. That is what we all really want. What a steal. Now, of course, there is an element of the ideal to this story, and for all our willingness, acts of kindness don't always end so happily. But should that actually stop us? How far are we prepared to replace the muddy and agonizing hues of self-cherishing with that moment-to-moment mindfulness that gives us the power to heal, to love, to care, and make our compassion visible? I guess we at least have the inclination, else why would we be here together right now? We could be doing 1,000 other things to amuse or entertain ourselves instead of exploring the Buddha's teachings. But here we are, trying to change our mindset through the mind-altering text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, by an ancient Tibetan Buddhist master, Namgyal Pel. Now, before we go further into this text, let's think about our motivation as we usually do. Why are you tuned in today? Is it for some everyday purpose, perhaps to build a reputation as a good and religious person, or just to fill the room with background noise while you do the daily chores? We can share our time together today for a much greater purpose than something like that, a purpose so great that it benefits not only ourselves, but a multitude of other beings as well. That purpose is, of course, bodhicitta, the wish to attain enlightenment to benefit all beings everywhere, the purpose I try to encourage for every program. So if you can, please make that your purpose. But if it's not possible, at least think of your own enlightenment. Thank you. Now getting back to Namgyal Pel. We haven't got too far into his text. We're still on what he has called the preliminary meditations, which are calculated to help us build the foundation for a consistent, sustained, and powerful practice. So far, we've considered the preciousness of this human rebirth, impermanence and death, and then over the last couple of programs, karma. If you remember, our modern interpretation of karma is action, the imprint that action places on the mind, and also the result that comes out of the action. Well, do you remember the four main characteristics of karma? The first is that karma is definite, which means that whatever action we do will lead us to an experience in accordance with that action. If the action is positive, colored if you like with love and care, it will lead to happiness, not necessarily at the time of the action, but for sure sometime in the future. Just like the abbot's kind actions led to the happy result he experienced when the monks and the committee praised him, but even more when the burglar became his good disciple. But it doesn't end there. The imprint on his mind of loving kindness and compassion will potentially bring further happy results for him in the future, possibly in coming lives. What if he had acted angrily or even fearfully? The outcome would have been totally different, and instead of the thief eventually taking the abbot as his revered teacher, he may have killed him then and there. So this indicates that a positive action will lead to a happy result, while a negative action will end in suffering. There's no way that a kind action will lead to suffering and a negative action to happiness. The second characteristic of karma is that karma multiplies. The Buddha said that we should not do a small negative action and think it doesn't matter, because small negative actions can lead to great suffering. Nor should we think that small positive acts don't matter, for from them can come great happiness. Just like an acorn can produce a huge oak tree, our actions can produce great results. Then the third characteristic is that the result of a deed not done will not be experienced. So, if we've not created the cause for a certain result, we will not experience that result. And finally, the fourth characteristic is that the results of the deeds we create will never fade away. Unless we are able to purify them, we will have to experience them, even if it is in many lifetimes on. We also saw last week with His Holiness the types of actions that will bring suffering, and their opposites, which will result in happiness. Do you know the 10 non-virtuous actions? They are the 3 of body, killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct, the 4 of speech, that is, lying, slander, harsh words, and gossip, and the 3 of mind, wrong views, harmful thoughts to others, and covetousness. Refraining from each of these negativities when we can commit them make up the 10 virtuous actions. So, for instance, the temple where I stay in Hamilton is usually free from cockroaches, but from time to time I will find one has made its way inside. I know that once they establish themselves inside, they're very difficult to get rid of and tend to invade everything. So I'm not keen for them to colonize the house. In my youth before Buddhism, it would have been easy. Call on the can of insect killer. But that's no longer an option, and I'm much more compelled to catch the cockroach and gently put it outside, far from the house, and with prayers for its happy life. I have the opportunity to kill it, and even in some dark recess of my mind, perhaps the thought is there to kill it. But actively, I refuse to do so and see the thought as unworthy. So acting out of kindness instead, I refrain from killing and try to preserve the life of the cockroach. Even if we compare the mind of aggression towards the creature with a mind that wishes it well, we can easily see the great difference. The one is hard, selfish, and ugly. The other softer, more compassionate and understanding. The first is already in a way unhappy, while the other is more peaceful and calm. So that completes the section on taking responsibility for one's actions and closely following the karmic law of cause and effect. Namkar Pel's text then goes on to the next preliminary, the drawbacks of cyclic existence. Here, by drawbacks, he means the suffering nature of cyclic existence. The Lam Rim, or graduated path to enlightenment, followed by the Gelugpa lineage of Tibetan Buddhism, goes into great detail on the various sufferings of cyclic existence. It describes the immediate general sufferings in 3 concise points, in 6 general points, and also calls on the 8 points the Buddha taught in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma at the Deer Park in Varanasi. It also goes into the specific sufferings of the 6 realms of cyclic existence, from the awful agony of the hells to the latent sufferings of the gods. However, Namkar Pel only lists the 6 general sufferings: uncertainty, dissatisfaction, dying again and again, being born again and again, changing status continually, and having to go ever alone. For the first one, uncertainty, he says, in cyclic existence, relationships with friends and enemies are very changeable. Things of this world are not at all reliable. They are miserable. And he quotes Nagarjuna's letter to a friend. Your father becomes your son, your mother your wife, and your enemies become friends. The opposite also takes place. Therefore, in cyclic existence, there is no certainty at all. He also quotes the Questions of Sabu Sutra, which says, at times, enemies turn out to be friends. And similarly, friends turn into foes. Likewise, anyone can become your father or mother, and even your parents can become your foes. Because friendship is changeable like this, the intelligent shun attachment. This misconceived thought that relations are pleasant is replaced by the joy of engaging in virtue. Now, there's one funny story told in the Lam Rim about one of Buddha's Arhat disciples and the uncertainty of cyclic existence. One version I've come across said it was Moggallana, another Shariputra. But anyway, let's say it was Moggallana, as he was renowned for his great psychic powers and was clairvoyant. In his wanderings, he came across a house beside a lake where a man was sitting at a table eating fish and cradling his young infant son. As the man threw the fish bones on the ground, the family's dog was trying to grab them to eat, but the man kept kicking the dog away. Through his clairvoyance, Moggallana saw that while a youth, the man had lived with his mother and father in the same house. The father very much enjoyed fishing in the lake, and his mother was very happy and house-proud living in her home by the lake. In due course, the youth had grown up and got married. One day, a stranger came by and was very taken by the young man's wife. But she refused his advances and he raped her. She told her husband, who was so enraged that he killed the stranger. In due course, the father died and was born as a fish in the lake because of his love for fishing. He was duly caught by his son and was actually the fish the man was eating as Moggallana came by. The mother had also died and was born as the house's dog through her attachment to the place. And because of his attachment for the young wife, the murdered stranger was born as the man's son. So here was the man, cradling his enemy, eating his father, and kicking his mother. Moggallana laughed. "Cyclic existence is such a joke," he said. In the programs on the three principal aspects of the path, I told a story of the friendship that develops between the U.S. pilot of a stealth fighter in the Kosovo War and the Serb man who shot him down with a land-to-air missile. That story was in connection with the six cause and one effect method of developing bodhicitta, the mind that wishes to attain enlightenment for all beings. Now I'm going to tell another very similar story about the pilots of a U.S. bomber and a German Messerschmitt in World War II. The full story is told in the book A Higher Call by Adam Marcos and Larry Alexander. But I've taken excerpts from an article, Two Enemies Discover a Higher Call in Battle, on the CNN website. It goes like this. The pilot glanced outside his cockpit and froze. He blinked hard and looked again, hoping it was just a mirage. But his co-pilot stared at the same horrible vision. "My God, this is a nightmare," the co-pilot said. "He's going to destroy us," the pilot agreed. The men were looking at a grey German Messerschmitt fighter hovering just 3 feet off their wingtip. It was 5 days before Christmas 1943, and the fighter had closed in on their crippled American B-17 bomber for the kill. The B-17 pilot, Charles Brown, was a 21-year-old West Virginia farm boy on his first combat mission. His bomber had been shot to pieces by swarming fighters, and his plane was alone in the skies above Germany. Half his crew was wounded, and the tail gunner was dead, his blood frozen in icicles over the machine guns. But when Brown and his co-pilot, Spencer Pinky Luke, looked at the fighter pilot again, something odd happened. The German didn't pull the trigger. He nodded at Brown instead. What happened next was one of the most remarkable acts of chivalry recorded during World War II. Revenge, not honor, is what drove 2nd Lieutenant Franz Stigler to jump into his fighter that chilly December day in 1943. Stigler wasn't just any fighter pilot. He was an ace. One more kill and he would win the Knight's Cross, Germany's highest award for valor. Yet Stigler was driven by something deeper than glory. His older brother, August, was a fellow Luftwaffe pilot who had been killed earlier in the war. American pilots had killed Stigler's comrades and were bombing his country's cities. Stigler was standing near his fighter on a German airbase when he heard a bomber's engine. Looking up, He saw a B-17 flying so low it looked like it was going to land. As the bomber disappeared behind some trees, Stigler tossed his cigarette aside, saluted a ground crewman, and took off in pursuit. As Stigler's fighter rose to meet the bomber, he decided to attack it from behind. He climbed behind the sputtering bomber, squinted into his gun sight, and placed his hand on the trigger. He was about to fire when he hesitated. Stigler was baffled. No one in the bomber fired at him. He looked closer at the tail gunner. He was still, his white fleece collar soaked with blood. Stigler craned his neck to examine the rest of the bomber. Its skin had been peeled away by shells, its guns knocked out. He could see men huddled inside the plane, tending the wounds of other crewmen. Then he nudged his plane alongside the bomber's wings and locked eyes with the pilot, whose eyes were wide with shock and horror. Stigler pressed his hand over the rosary he kept in his flight jacket. He eased his index finger off the trigger. He couldn't shoot. It would be murder. Stigler wasn't just motivated by vengeance that day. He also lived by a code. He could trace his family's ancestry to knights in 16th century Europe. He'd once studied to be a priest. A German pilot who spared the enemy, though, risked death in Nazi Germany. If someone reported him, he would be executed. Yet Stigler could also hear the voice of his commanding officer, who once told him, "You follow the rules of war for you, not your enemy. You fight by rules to keep your humanity." Alone with the crippled bomber, Stigler changed his mission. He nodded at the American pilot and began flying in formation so German anti-aircraft gunners on the ground wouldn't shoot down the slow-moving bomber. The Luftwaffe had B-17s of its own, shot down and rebuilt for secret missions and training. Stigler escorted the bomber over the North Sea, took one last look at the American pilot. Then he saluted him, peeled his fighter away, and returned to Germany. "Good luck," Stigler said to himself. "You're in God's hands." As he watched the German fighter peel away that December day, Second Lieutenant Charles Brown wasn't thinking of the philosophical connections between enemies. He was thinking of survival. He flew back to his base in England and landed with barely any fuel left. After his bomber came to a stop, he leaned back in his chair and put a hand over a pocket Bible he kept in his flight jacket. Then he sat in silence. Brown flew more missions before the war ended. Life moved on. He got married, had two daughters, supervised foreign aid for the U.S. State Department during the Vietnam War, and eventually retired to Florida. Late in life, though, the encounter with a German pilot began to gnaw at him. He started having nightmares, but in his dream, there would be no act of mercy. He would awaken just before his bomber crashed. Brown took on a new mission. He had to find that German pilot. Who was he? Why did he save my life? He scoured military archives in the US and England. He attended a pilot reunion and shared his story. He finally placed an ad in a German newsletter for former Luftwaffe pilots, retelling the story and asking if anyone knew the pilot. On January 18, 1990, Brown received a letter. He opened it and read, "Dear Charles, all these years I wondered what happened to the B-17. Did she make it or not?" It was Stigler. He had left Germany after the war and moved to Vancouver, British Columbia in 1953. Became a prosperous businessman. Now retired, Stigler told Brown that he would be in Florida come summer and it sure would be nice to talk about our encounter. Brown was so excited, though, that he couldn't wait to see Stigler. He called directory assistance for Vancouver and asked whether there was a number for a Franz Stigler. He dialed the number and Stigler picked up. "My God, it's you!" Brown shouted as tears ran down his cheeks. Brown had to do more. He wrote a letter to Stigler in which he said to say, "Thank you, thank you, thank you on behalf of my surviving crew members and their families appears totally inadequate." The two pilots would meet again, but this time in the lobby of a Florida hotel. One of Brown's friends was there to record the summer reunion. Both men looked like retired businessmen. They were plump, sporting neat ties and formal shirts. They talked about their encounter in a light, jovial tone. Then the mood changed. Someone asked Stigler what he thought about Brown. Stigler sighed and his square jaw tightened. He began to fight back tears before he said in heavily accented English, "I love you, Charlie." Stigler had lost his brother, his friends, and his country. He was virtually exiled by his countrymen after the war. There were 28,000 pilots who fought for the German Air Force. Only 1,200 survived, according to the author Adam Marcus. "The war cost him everything," Marcus says. "Charlie Brown was the only good thing that came out of World War II for France. It was the one thing he could be proud of." The meeting helped Brown as well, says his oldest daughter, Dawn Warner. Brown and Stigler became pals. They would take fishing trips together. They would fly cross-country to each other's homes and take road trips together to share their story at schools and veterans' reunions. Their wives, Jackie Brown and Hiya Stigler, became friends. Brown's daughter says her father would worry about Stigler's health and constantly check in on him. "It wasn't just for show," she says. "They really did feel for each other. They talked about once a week." As his friendship with Stigler deepened, something else happened to her father, Warner says. The nightmares went away. Brown had written a letter of thanks to Stigler, but one day he showed the extent of his gratitude. He organized a reunion of his surviving crew members, along with their extended families. He invited Stigler as a guest of honor. During the reunion, a video was played showing all the faces of the people that now lived. Children, grandchildren, relatives, because of Stigler's act of chivalry. Stigler watched the film from his seat of honor. "Everybody was crying, not just him," Warner says. Stigler and Brown died within months of each other in 2008. Stigler was 92 and Brown was 87. They'd started off as enemies, became friends, and then something more. Marcos discovered what that was by accident while spending a night at Brown's house. He was poking through Brown's library when he came across a book on German fighter jets. Stigler had given the book to Brown. Both were country boys who loved to read about planes. Marcos opened the book and saw an inscription Stigler had written to Brown. "In 1940, I lost my only brother as a night fighter. On the 20th of December, 4 days before Christmas, I had the chance to save a B-12 from her destruction. A plane so badly damaged, it was a wonder that she was still flying. The pilot, Charlie Brown, is for me as precious as my brother was. Thanks, Charlie. Your brother, Franz." Does this story really explain the uncertainty that is the first of the six sufferings of cyclic existence? It certainly says something about karma and how a single act can have very far-reaching results. And yes, I think it does show how those we may, through circumstance, regard as our enemies, can become our dearest friends. It's unfortunate that it goes the other way also. I'm sure you know of situations in which two people who seem destined to be friends for life turn out, equally through change in circumstances, to be sworn enemies. Remember the play Beckett by Jean Henri, which tells of the great friendship between Henry II and his chancellor, Thomas Becket, but how they became enemies when the king made Becket the Archbishop of Canterbury. In its day, the film starring Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole was one of my favourites, and the story neatly shows the uncertainty in this type of existence of ours, except, of course, for the certainty that as we are alive, we must die. And with that, farewell, for our time is up. Thanks for joining the program today. But before going, let's dedicate our discussion, hopefully, to bodhicitta. May we attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Thank you, and all the best for the coming week. Goodbye.